Hi everyone, my name is Yarrow and you're listening to the Making and Mending podcast. I am so excited to share this episode with you. I'm still in my post-leg surgery retreat, resting lots, looking at the sky, taking it easy. But today I'm working for a few hours to send you an episode, to draft a newsletter, to catch up with my inbox and connect with the world a little bit. I am so excited to share this interview with Isabella Rosner with you because Isabella's work and especially her podcast has inspired me for a really long time. Isabella is also really into textile history, and we talked a little bit about how she got into it, about her PhD, about her work with the Royal School of Needlework, about how much textiles can really teach us about the human experience as a whole, on an emotional, spiritual, practical level. So, you know, all these things I love to talk and think about, and I really hope that you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Thank you so much again for listening. Hello, everyone. I can't tell you how excited I am to interview Dr. Isabella Rosner today. You probably have heard me mention that I'm such a big fan of her podcast, Sue What. She recently became the curator of the Royal School of Needlework, and she's also a research associate at Whitney Antiques and this I only recently found out, a new generation thinker, which is so cool. But Isabella loves so many things that I'm really into as well. I think you would adore the Sue What podcast. It's so incredible. And yeah, I'm just really excited to talk to you and to get really geeky about textile history, Isabella. Thank you so much for making time. I'm really
excited. Thank you so much. I'm truly, Yarrow, thank you so much for having me. I am so excited about this. I always say so and then realize I'm like putting on SEW. So, but truly, I am thrilled to be here and I cannot wait to chat. So thank you.
Thank you. I would start with a fairly simple question. Like, how did you get into textile history? Can you tell us a bit more about whether you were in contact with these practices growing up, or is it new to you? How did you get so excited?
Good question. I came to textiles through loving historical dress. So I grew up in Los Angeles, where there's not a lot of very visible history, because a lot of it was unfortunately destroyed by white settlers. And when I was like 12, I had an English teacher who made her students read one classic novel a month. So I started reading Little Women and Catcher in the Rye and all of the Jane Austen novels. And I started watching the kind of mini series adaptations and the film adaptations. And my mind was blown. I had always been interested in fashion, but I guess I kind of forgot that like people of the past also needed to wear clothing. So when I started watching these kind of adaptations, I was like, oh my God, their clothes are so beautiful. Wow, I'm so fascinated by how they dress. And that really launched me deep into the world of historical fashion. I wanted to be a costume designer. And then I had a few costume design experiences working in film and TV that made me realize it wasn't quite the right mixture, for me at least, of research and creativity. So I started drifting towards museums or thinking about how I could get employed in a museum. I was lucky enough to intern at a few museums, and the first one was the Nantucket Historical Association, which is, Nantucket is like a tiny island off the coast of Massachusetts in the United States. And I was working at a house where they taught historical arts and crafts classes. And when I was there, somebody named Edie Borier, who was a powerhouse, she's like 98 now. I don't know. She's awesome. She started telling me about samplers. I did not know what a sampler was. I did not know that they basically served as genealogical documents and that they held within their stitches so much information about a girl and the world in which she lived. And that's really what launched me into textiles. I've always loved people, normal people, their material culture, and how they made their lives rich. And I found that textiles and working with textiles in kind of heritage institutions offered me not only an opportunity to get to know these people of the past better, but also to combine research and creativity. I should say that all of my female family members are really into fashion and textiles. They love embroidery and floral things, but we did not come from a family that was very sticky or very textile-y at all. one of my grandmas seems to have done some cross stitch earlier in her life, and the other one not so much. But nobody in my family taught me how to sew or how to stitch. I actually started learning when I was a Girl Scout. We had to make pillows. And then from there, I asked my parents if I could take some sewing classes. So I learned how to sew on a sewing machine, I think when I was maybe 11 or 12. And I think a lot of people in my family are very excited about my interest in textiles. And it's clearly within our blood, because when my ancestors moved to the U.S. about a century ago, they were working a lot in women's fashion and the textile trades more generally. It's just that in the more immediate generations, it's been less of an art form that they are that people have done at home. That was such a long story. Sorry.
Oh, I loved every second of it. No, thank you so much. In your podcast, you're covering so much ground. You're clearly passionate about so many beautiful, super niche things. And I'm always curious how people narrow down to a specific topic for their PhD. I have moments in my life where I'm kind of PhD curious. I'm currently doing another master's. Yeah, but oh God, it's just so hard to narrow down. And then part of me just wants to keep doing more master's if I can afford it. I can spend like a year or two on, you know, one topic, but then also kind of keep my options open. So how did you do it? How on earth did you do it? Was there a flow chart? Did you have like a lot of sticky notes on the wall?
I think like everybody who's interested in historical embroidery, my first idea was this one that I think we all reach, which is trying to figure out how something that has to do with embroidery moved around the world, whether it's how the people who were stitching moved around the world, how their motifs moved around the world, how patterns and materials migrated around various continents. So for me, I was really interested in tracking movement of motifs around the planet, and then realized that's gigantic. That's not only a gigantic and too big undertaking, it also wouldn't really work because so much of that migration and movement of people and ideas around the world when it comes to embroidery isn't written down. That information does not really exist in an archive. It exists mostly in objects, but we aren't left with the complete material record of everything. So it's really, really a very difficult undertaking to try to piece together the history of migration when it comes to embroidery based on only what survives. It felt too daunting, but I had a list on my phone. Then one day it came to me in a really unexpected way. So my PhD was on Quaker women's art, which was needlework, waxwork, and shellwork before 1800. I am not a Quaker. I think they're very cool, and I've always liked Quakers, but they never really crossed my mind very much. But when I was working at Colonial Williamsburg, my boss, who was the textile curator, also oversaw other non-textile forms of schoolgirl art. So somebody emailed her, and this person was doing a master's in Delaware, and the person emailed my boss saying, "Hi, I've heard that you have a few relevant objects that have to do with wax and shell work from 18th century Philadelphia. Is this the case?" And my boss said, "Hi, Isabella, this would be a good project for you." And she passed the email on to me. And I was kind of made to look at these various pieces of wax work and shell work. They look like dioramas that would sit on your tabletop. And I sadly wasn't even able to get the information to her in time because I had to leave Colonial Williamsburg early because of illness. And the objects are huge, so I couldn't get them to photography in time. But I just remember sitting on the floor of the textile storage space because these objects were on the lowest level of kind of the storage system, and pulling back this sheet that they were under and seeing these two really very large and incredibly impressive dioramas. And I looked at their catalog entries, and they said that both of them were made by Quaker women, and they were pretty solid provenances. These objects looked not at all like what I was expecting from Quakers. They are really sizable, and they're like these deep wooden boxes that have a glass pane in the front so you can look into them, and it's like you're looking into another world. And they have these really small, very delicately crafted wax figures, mostly women. And hundreds and thousands of shells and glitter that's made out of mica flakes, and there's handmade coral, and there's little alabaster dogs. There's a level of detail that is really, really overwhelming and mind-blowing. And I was confused because I was used to, in my other museum jobs, seeing Quaker needlework. And most of the Quaker needlework I had seen had come from about 1800 or later. And it was what stitchers today would consider a Quaker medallion sampler. So plain pieces of linen covered in these sorts of standalone monochrome motifs, things like flowers and swans and squirrels. They're very stylized. But these shadow boxes, what these kind of dioramas that I ended up calling shadow boxes, looked not at all like what I thought was typical of Quaker art. And seeing these wax and shellwork pieces reminded me of an exhibition catalog that had come out the year before, written by a former boss of mine, Carol Humphrey, at the Fitzwilliam Museum. And it was an exhibition catalog called Sampled Lives, based around an exhibition that was all about samplers. And he had an entire chapter about Quaker samplers and how some of the brightest, most decorative band samplers of 17th century England actually came from Quakers in and around the city of London. So as I'm looking at these shadow boxes, I was thinking back to Carol Humphrey's chapter and being like, wait, there's clearly something here where it's only after around 1800 that Quaker women's art becomes this sort of plain, stylized thing that most of us know it to be. What was happening before that? Clearly, these do not look very simple or plain to my eyes. And that is what launched me into this project. It was the luck of somebody emailing my boss and my boss telling me to look into this thing. So I'm very grateful to that person, very grateful to everybody involved, because I don't think I would have come to the topic of Quaker women's art if it wasn't for being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm. It sounds almost like you found your topic, but your topic kind of also found you in a really romantic way.
I like that. I think that it's interesting. I didn't know when I started my PhD that there were other people looking at this general field. And it turns out that there were. And one of those people is now my boss. I was actually put in touch with her by Carol Humphrey, who wrote that exhibition catalog, because she had been looking at a group of Quaker needlework for about 10 years. I find it really interesting that by the time I started my thesis, I didn't know anything about the other people working in the field of Quaker material culture. But now there's like a whole group of us, and turns out people were doing this way before I was. I just didn't know. So it's a really exciting community to be a part of. I never expected to do a PhD at all. So I'm still kind of amazed that that's what happened.
Yeah, amazing. I agree. It feels so exciting how willing people are to be generous and connect you, because it is such a fascinating field, but it's also so specific. And I always feel like when I encounter people who have an overlap with my interest, there's so much enthusiasm and like people really want to, you know, help you along on your next step. So that's really exciting.
I agree. It's so nice. Everybody's so generous.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say, I almost cried when I heard that you started working at the RSN. That was so exciting to me. And I think I had been listening to your podcast for so long, and then you announced it. I was like, oh my God, that is still like something in the universe that makes sense. You know, that's amazing.
That's so nice of you. Wow. Thank you.
What are your hopes and dreams for the collection? Like what is it like at the moment?
I want people to know that the RSN has a large and really varied collection. It's, you know, this has been a project from the Royal School of Needlework trying to get the collection and archive digitized for like 10 years. And they have finally raised the funds to do it. And I'm just thrilled to be involved, because it's so rare, I feel, to be introduced to a collection, especially a collection of textiles that you did not know existed before. And I have loved the RSN, like you and like so many people have, for so long, and I did not know that there even was a collection that had anything of significance until about, like, I think 2022. It took me a long time to even realize. So I'm really excited that we are making everything available to the public on this public-facing website, collections website. And it's going to take a long time because there are, I think the estimate is about 10,000 objects in the collection. I think there's probably a bit more than that. And every object has to be thoroughly researched as we put them online. So it's going to take a long time, but I'm just so thrilled that people will get a chance to realize that there are all these objects out there that they didn't even know existed before. And the RSN collection is fascinating because it's made up entirely of donations. And the RSN has been accepting objects since probably its very beginning. And for many decades, there was no information written down about these objects, where they came from or what they are. So there's a lot of really surprising stuff. There's a lot of objects that you would not see in other museums because they're more unusual and more, I guess, quote unquote, normal. They're more of the everyday textiles of the average person. And so I'm finding some really, really surprising and exciting stuff. And it's things like, there's a pair of slippers that was labeled as Turkish. And I understand why they look like they could be Turkish in style, but they're actually Peranakan. And Peranakan is the mixture of Chinese culture with Malaysian, Singapore, or Thai culture, or Indonesian, this kind of mixing together of a blending together of immigrant groups. The Chinese immigrants went to that region and then kind of blended together their cultures. And these slippers are a thrill to me. And I think about them all the time because I cannot think of another museum in Britain, in the United States, that has a pair of these slippers. And perhaps I've not been looking in the right places, but as I was doing research on them, it really feels like there are just not that many in this part of the world. And it's exciting to me that the RSN collection can fill in some gaps in all parts of textile history.
Yeah, I was just nodding along. Yes, I was so excited about that too. And I'm so overjoyed the funding is in place for the digitization. I mean, my head just explodes when I think about what that is going to make possible in the future. You touched on, yeah, you touched on a few things that you're excited about already, but I wonder, and this is such a broad question, so feel free to take this in any direction, but what do you feel textiles can teach us about the human experience at this point in being alive, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Okay, not to be dramatic, but I feel like they can teach us everything about the human experience because textiles are so innately human. We see, well, they're universal in that for, you know, the vast majority of the human experience, the human history, we have been clothed in textiles. We have surrounded ourselves with textiles in home and on our bodies. We have always sought out the warmth, the comfort, and the decoration that's possible through textiles. So I think that we learn so much just by this idea of thinking about textiles, but textiles are so tied to the human hand and to human knowledge, whether it's the hands that have woven a piece or they've knit or crocheted them, or, you know, they have embroidered upon them. You're seeing labor and you're seeing expertise, you're seeing creativity. And I think that the fact that there's so much that one can do with textiles, not only how they craft textiles, but colors, materials, images, size, everything. It just speaks to the infinite possibilities of what it means to be human, that everybody has their own life experience and every textile can be different. I think that I love studying textiles because they make me feel, I love studying historical textiles because they make me feel closer to the people of the past. Through that study, I get to know not only how people clothed themselves and decorated their homes, but also how they were repairing their clothing and their home furnishings, what materials they had available to them. Were they in a cold place or a hot place? How soft was this textile? Where are the areas of wear? You get a real insight into not only who was living, but how they were living. And I think that is just so powerful and just so cool. Their insights into all of us.
Yeah, I totally agree. I love that you said everything, because that's exactly what I would say to that Yay. Question as well. Yeah. I also feel like it is such a beautiful way to learn about politics and history, because I think if you haven't had any other chance to kind of really dive into some things that you're interested in, it can feel really overwhelming outside of education to make a start and, you know, or join something or find a topic that you want to research some more. But textiles are something that touch all our lives in some ways. And it's such a gentle, human, grounded way to be like, you know, hey, like, how did people feel about bodies at that time? How did we arrive at this point? And how can we get to a better point, for example, or learning more about, yeah, or learning more about colonialism and trade and economic violence. I think that too can feel so vast and overwhelming and difficult to touch sometimes, but I think textiles sometimes make it really tangible for me and kind of prevent me from looking away from things, because they just really affect me too. You know, I too dress myself, and I need to understand where these things come from and how they were made and what impact they have. And yeah, I think that's something that we can all think about.
I think that's so beautifully said. And you're right. Textiles are, the fact that they're accessible and that you can hold one piece of textile in your hands means that they're gateways through which you can understand. They're big, huge, and oftentimes very distressing issues like colonialism, capitalism, you know, like racism, like all these isms, right? All of these big, bad, scary things can be understandable through oftentimes a single piece of textile. The textile tells the story of human subjugation as well. They have the capacity to talk about human subjugation and human joy and everything in between. And you're right, it's easier to engage with those massive and oftentimes very difficult to understand issues when you have a tangible piece of that story in front of you, in your hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you're so busy with all the different things that you're doing, especially with being a new generation thinker, which is so cool. But do you have a creative practice of your own at the moment? And if so, what is that like?
Oh, I wish. I am talking a lot to people about this. Every time I talk to somebody who does a lot of reading and writing about and speaking about textiles, I will ask them, like, where are you at with your art making practice? And they're always like, it's not going well. And I say, I agree, it's not going well. And that's unfortunately because I really, really love all the work I do. I love constantly speaking to people about textiles and writing about them and handling them and researching them. But I do find that the more that I do that, the less time I have to actually do the thing. And I think that's because my own problem in that I'm not great at prioritizing self-care and moments of well-being for me. And that is what my creative practice is oftentimes, is sewing or knitting or embroidering to free my mind and slow down. I'm not very good at prioritizing that at all. And I often feel that I get into a like not great cycle where the more that I study some of the finest embroidery that survives, the more I'm like, I couldn't do this. You know, the more I'm studying an 11-year-old's amazing sampler, the more I get a little bit like, oh no, what does my stitching look like in comparison? I know that it should not be like that, and that every stitch is a good stitch. And I can't aim for the perfection of a random 11-year-old sampler, but it is a humbling and weird experience sometimes to be looking at this stuff all day and then to go home and look at my tiny little weird freestyle embroidery project and then just say, these things are different. Interesting. So the short answer is my creative practice at the moment is not very active and not as active as I want it to be. I'm constantly trying to make myself do it, but it unfortunately comes really low on my list of priorities, and that is a huge problem and something that haunts me a little bit. So yes, this is a moment of honesty for me. There you go. I'm being very embarrassingly vulnerable.
Thank you. Oh God, I totally get that. I think that it just makes sense. You do so many things, and I can also totally understand this. These questions that can bring up. Although I also truly think that your freestyle stitching is probably truly beautiful. But I love what
That's
you said
very
that
nice,
every every stitch is beautiful. Yeah, every stitch is perfect. I think that too is such a beautiful aspect of textiles and maybe embroidery specifically, that there's such a wide range in how we can approach it, where we can really become these super perfectionists and do it technically right, you know, and work on huge pieces that have so much intricate detail. But at the same time, we can also just have like a little bit of embroidery in our pockets and just do something abstract or stitch away, and that too can be so meaningful and beautiful. And I love how that too kind of really reflects the whole human experience, right? Like when I look at older pieces of mine, I can really tell where I was at in my head at that time and what I was thinking about and working through and how. So yeah, that's interesting.
Absolutely. I agree. Mm-hmm. I think that stitch, specifically textiles in general, but I mean, my own bias is embroidery. And I think that it has so much capacity to tell stories, whether you want it to tell a story or not. But you're right. It's the story of how did you feel that day? What does that stitch look like? What color were you using? How's the tension in your embroidery hoop? What are you stitching and how are you stitching it? And I oftentimes feel slightly frustrated with embroidery that when it comes to the historical pieces, you have a lot of information about what people were stitching. We have all these objects and we know how they were stitching them as well. The materials they were using, what they had available to them, their colors, their stitches, all of that stuff. But what's oftentimes absent is how the person feels when they're embroidering. Very rarely are people stitching saying things like, I'm hating this, or I love stitching. You know, you're not oftentimes making a sampler that says that. And I find that absence frustrating every so often. But I also find it freeing because it means that in order to find how somebody feels and in order to find the emotional landscape within the piece, you have to look a bit deeper and look elsewhere. You have to look to indeed how they are stitching and what they are stitching, not what they're saying, but what their stitches themselves say. I hope that made sense.
Oh, yes, totally makes sense. Yeah, I love it.
Oh, good. Thank you.
You were such a beautiful well of like fun fact in textile history. Oh. So I really want everyone to check your podcast out, of course, because there's so much more where that came from. But can you maybe just touch a little bit on frog bags and embroidered nutmegs and anything else you want to share?
Oh my goodness, yes. Actually, great day for it because here we are recording on Leap Day. I am wearing a dress that is covered in frogs because I was like, frogs pop, frogs leap. And so I have been thinking about frog pouches all day. So for those of you not familiar with frog pouches, there are at least six known extant frog pouches that are from the 17th century from England. And they are these absolutely minuscule pouches that look like frogs. They're just a few centimeters tall. They're tiny. And they open at the frog's mouth because frogs are kind of pouch shaped. And each one is different. So there are examples. Let's see if I remember where all of them are. Okay, one was sold at Pook and Pook, so it's in a private collection. There's one at the Museum of London, Ashmolean, LACMA, the Royal Collection Trust, and the University of Alberta. Aha! Yes, all six. And each one of these looks different, which to me suggests that it's not just a single workshop making these tiny needleworked frog pouches, that there was enough of a trend going on that multiple people were making them. And it's clear that it's not, I don't know if it's professionals or people in the home, but it is clear that schoolgirls were engaging with this as well, because the one in the University of Alberta is perhaps the least sophisticated and is also found within a 17th century schoolgirl casket, which does suggest that she made it herself. And I just love the broad variety there of people engaging with this. So I started thinking about why frogs. In about 2017, I was an intern at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and I was lucky enough to see one of these frog pouches. It's amazing. It's absolutely tiny. And being an inquisitive weirdo, I saw that thing and I thought, but why a frog? That's very specific, because all of a sudden I started seeing all these other ones online. and it feels like 6 different frog pouches is quite a lot. I made a TikTok about these frogs, I think sometime last year, and I said the trend of 17th century frog pouches. And everybody was like, what do you mean trend? There are only 6. And yeah, it made me second guess stuff, but I was thinking, okay, 6 different frog pouches from 350 years ago, approx, maybe even 400 years ago, is a lot. That's a lot of stuff that survives. I have a lot of really wacky theories about why frogs were the choice. You know, there is the basic fact that frogs have a pouch-like body, so it's certainly possible that people were just making bags shaped like frogs because frogs already look like pouches. But I have a lot of theories about what involves Queen Elizabeth and one of her suitors. One of them involves a Ben Jonson mask, a play. One of them involves a printing of Aesop's Fables. And perhaps I think that there might be a connection between maybe toad amulets, frog amulets, and plague. There's a lot of different stuff going on. And my brain is just mush when it comes to frog pouches because I feel like there are so many factors. And it's this difficult thing of, we have all these material survivals, but they never appear in the written record that I've seen, and they never appear in painted information. They are never in paintings or in print sources. So there's this absence in the archive, whereas there's a pretty big presence in the material record. It haunts me. Okay, so that's my big frog spiel. If you are curious about frog pouches and what my crazy theories are, I would recommend you listen to one of my earliest podcast episodes, which is about frog pouches. I think it's called Hopping into Frog Pouches, perhaps. And I have an article in the Journal of Early Modern Studies about frog pouches as they tie to plague. And eventually there will be a book chapter out in the world about my various theories, but that's been a very, very long time coming. So I'm not sure when that will come out. Okay, so now that I've done frogs, nutmegs. All I do, it feels like in my entire life at this point, is tell people about nutmeg facts. But basically, in the 17th century, nutmegs were a hugely coveted luxury item, and that's because they were rare, extremely expensive, and considered very important for culinary purposes and also to prevent against illness, specifically plague. So in the second half of the 17th century, we have a few examples that survive of embroidered nutmegs. So a person would have taken a nutmeg and like literally covered it in stitching. There's one at V&A, there's one at the Ashmolean, there's one at the National Museum of Scotland. And then there are 4 more, which is crazy, in a surviving entire suite of needlework made by a girl named Elizabeth Hall. Elizabeth Hall was a Quaker in London, and all of her childhood needlework survives, as well as all of the needlework of many generations of her descendants. And it's all in the collection of Whitney Antiques in Oxfordshire. And included in this suite are 4 embroidered nutmegs that Elizabeth Hall made when she was at a Quaker school in Hackney called Shacklewell. And they are crazy because, okay, nutmeg numbers time. Nutmegs were worth more than their weight in gold in 17th century England. From the time that they were gathered in Indonesia's Banda Islands to their sale in London, there was a 68,000% markup. They were so unbelievably expensive. So it's crazy to have not only 4 nutmegs, but to render them completely useless by covering them in stitch. You can no longer grate the nutmegs. And that is how you used a nutmeg. You grated it, but you can't grate it if it's covered in thread. And what's extra crazy is that in her suite, Elizabeth Hall has 2 more nutmegs. It's just that she didn't embroider them. We don't know if she was going to embroider them or not, but they are plain and unadorned. This girl had 6 nutmegs. That is so many. Yes, it's absolutely wild. I just am constantly thinking about nutmegs. Yeah!
It makes me so happy. Amazing. It is amazing, and it makes me so happy that you're thinking about frog purses on leap day. That is amazing.
Oh, it just feels so right. I mean, thanks for asking the question as I wear this frog dress. It just, it's the right day for it.
You just know how to live. That's how it is. That's my theory. Before I let you go, is there anything else you want to share? And do you want to let people know where they can find you, but also maybe where they can find out more about the RSN and your podcast and all those different things?
Okay, yes. Right. I always ask people this on my podcast, but I have no list ready. So I'm just going to, let's see what comes to my mind. So I'm very online. I share a lot on Twitter. I will not be calling it X. And on Instagram. On Twitter, my name is Isabella Rosner, and I am at Isabella Rosner. And then on Instagram, I'm Historic Embroidery. And I just post a lot of fun things that I'm thinking about, things that I'm writing about, stuff I'm researching. I am embarrassingly on TikTok. I make a very rare appearance on TikTok every few months, and I'm Historic Embroidery on there as well. I have a podcast, as Yarrow has mentioned, called So What, S-E-W, What? And that has social media pages as well. And I share images of everything I discuss in each episode on those pages. What else? I recently was lucky enough to have a little book published by Common Threads Press. It's called Stitching Freedom, and it's about the history of embroidery and incarceration. So it's what we were talking about earlier about embroidery's capacity to tell stories and what we didn't really talk about, which is capacity to help people deal with anger and to deal with an almost complete loss of agency and how people express themselves, pass the time, regain that sense of self when so much of that has been taken away from them. So that's available now. You can go to commonthreadspress.co.uk. So the Royal School of Needlework, there's so much to know. So if you want to know more about the RSN, the website is royal-needlework.org.uk. The RSN has a stitch bank, which is truly amazing. It has basically an encyclopedic database of all of the world's embroidery stitches. And they're constantly adding to it because the list of embroidery stitches is infinite. But if you look up RSN Stitch Bank, you will find it and it will change your life. The RSN collection and archive will be publicly shared with the world in mid-April. We will be posting announcements about that. And we're starting with the first 100, which is like a random selection of objects and archival documentation that represent the breadth and depth of the collection and archive. And so that's just the first kind of random 100. And then from there, I will be uploading more objects, catalog records in batches every month or so. And I think that's it. I said a lot of stuff. Wow. Thanks for bearing with me.
Yeah, you did. And it was also beautiful. I'm going to link to these things in the show notes as well. And I'm excited to hear that the first 100 are already coming in mid-April. That is amazing.
I thought it was going to be a post-Easter treat for people, you know? I don't know.
Wow, that makes me truly happy. I can't wait. Isabella, thank you so much. Thank you so much for what you shared today, for all your work, your insights, your enthusiasm, for your podcast, and for making time for me today. It was really great to talk.
Yarrow, it was totally my pleasure. I had such a brilliant time. Thank you for this opportunity. Thanks for such a fun chat as well. It just feels like we're already best friends. I hope you're okay with that.
Yes, totally. Thank you so much.